ready to sail.
These were ordinary men and women, the strong, the violent, the tender, and the weak. But they were marked for greatness, with the immortal courage to risk any danger to find a free world. Here, something new and bright and glorious had its beginning. Plymouth Adventure is first the human story of a strange fascination and the regeneration of a disillusioned man. My adventure awaits you when you sail with the Mayflower. The story of the courage and daring of brave men. A story that is great because it has the breadth of reality in every scene. Brought to life through the magic of motion pictures with the vivid miracle of color. The kind of drama for which the giant theater screen was made.
Ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. I'm your host, Kristen Lopez.
And I'm Samantha Ellis.
We are celebrating Thanksgiving by looking at the first Thanksgiving on film. Actually, the movie isn't even really about the first Thanksgiving. It's just about getting to America to eventually celebrate Thanksgiving. We're talking about 1952's Plymouth Adventure. We are recording this on Thanksgiving Day. We were both at home and figured, why not record a podcast? And before we get to talking about Plymouth Adventure, there's been a lot of discussion on Twitter, especially with the closure of Filmstruck happening, about being thankful for classic film and being thankful for what old movies and TCM. So we just wanted to talk for a couple of minutes about the things we're thankful for when it comes to our love of old Hollywood. So I'm going to let Samantha go first.
Great. Well, I would first have to say that I'm really thankful to all of our listeners and all of the people that I've interacted with on social media this year. I feel like I've become a lot more connected to people involved with old Hollywood this year than any other. And I'd also really love to thank everyone involved in film restoration, especially on Filmstruck, every single person who contributed to the greatness that Filmstruck was and is still for another week. It's just incredible. And I'm going to miss it. I'm going to miss it a lot, but we wouldn't even have had it in the first place if it weren't for amazing people like Scott McGee, Jill Blake, countless others. I'm really thankful for all of that and all of you.
I'm thankful for John Garfield. No, I am thankful for that. But that's one of many things that I'm thankful for when it comes to classic film. When we, especially Samantha and I, talk about our love of old Hollywood, that sense of community that comes with specifically being a TCM fan. I've talked about this before with other people, but TCM is pretty much the only channel I know that feels like there's people behind it. You know, you can message Disney or any other corporation and you aren't really interacting with a person. You're interacting with an employee. And that's really not true with TCM. You're interacting with people that you know, that you can meet. There's that limiting of the wall between the two of you. So when Samantha mentions certain people, I feel like I know those people too, because we see them at least once a year. If you go to the festival, you interact with them regularly on Twitter. I am definitely thankful for the listeners, and I'm thankful for my co-hosts, Samantha and Drea Clark, who keep me from thinking, I shouldn't do this podcast anymore. No one listens to it. Why do I do this? It's so time consuming. These two really keep me from just throwing in the towel and remind me of why I do it, which is because we love talking about old movies. There are other podcasts out there that do that, and they're fantastic. My mortal nemesis in my head, Karina Longworth, she's not really my mortal nemesis, but a lot of people confuse us because we both do classic film podcasts, and we both have the same initials, so I've just subconsciously made her my quote-unquote nemesis. She's great. Fantastic Sass Mouth Dames, bunch of other classic film podcasts that exist out there. We're a very niche community, and so I feel very grateful to be a part of that and always hear that people listen to the show and enjoy it. I am grateful for Plymouth Adventure. Samantha suggested this. I had never heard of this movie up until she suggested, for Thanksgiving, wouldn't it be really funny to do Plymouth Adventure? And I said, what is Plymouth Adventure? And then I looked it up and I said, oh no. Because I know, and I know Samantha knows, and a lot of other people who watch classic film know, that when movies of the 40s and the 50s especially tried to talk about historical times, you're in for a long, lengthy, weird treat. Thankfully, this is not long. This is about, what, an hour and 46 minutes?
Right.
And so it's a very truncated epic, even though it wants to feel like it's an epic. It's a very short film, but oh, does it hit on every factor on the list. When people say, I don't watch classic films because of this, I feel they're talking about Plymouth Adventure. This movie was, it was everything I expected it to be, which was that I knew I wasn't going to like it at the end. It's really fun for me to have a movie that I actually had a harsh reaction to. If you listen to the last episode, when Dre and I talked about Murder My Sweet, I didn't really have a visceral reaction to it. I thought it was good, but I wasn't effusive in my praise, and I also didn't hate it. This, I have a reaction, which is that, oh god, this is bad. This is bad. Samantha, you suggested this. What is your background with it before we recorded, and what do you think of this weird little MGM movie?
Honestly, this is a movie that I had only heard about myself last year, because apparently TCM does play this film around Thanksgiving, sometimes not on Thanksgiving every year. I believe last year it was on Thanksgiving.
I know, and that this year they showed it 4 days before, because that's how I watched it.
I don't know why they did that. I just saw it on the schedule and I was like, it's extremely fitting, has a great cast. I thought it would be funny initially to discuss it. I figured it would be this comical, historically inaccurate. I was expecting all of those things, but I have to admit that I didn't have as much of an adverse reaction to it as you did. I actually liked it a lot more than I thought I would.
You are a saint, because I can't say this is the worst movie. I would never say this is the worst movie. I would never say that this is a movie that egregiously ruins history. In fact, I was really surprised with what this movie doesn't do. Before we get into that, I'll throw out the plot. This is about the group of settlers that go from England. England, remember this when I start naming actors. England. They go to Virginia in 1620, but because their captain, played by Spencer Tracy, Christopher Jones, is being paid to take them to a different place, they end up on Plymouth Rock in Massachusetts and starting America. It's got a cast that includes Spencer Tracy, Gene Tierney, Van Johnson, Leo Genn, Barry Jones, Don Adams, and Lloyd Bridges. England! This movie starts in England. How many English people are in this movie, Samantha?
About zero. I find that that's a trend in classic films.
It is. I was going to say, this is not unexpected.
Well, not only that, it's almost a little bit, I don't want to say offensive, but the fact that the lead characters are always 100% American, no matter what the country is that they're supposed to be from. But these side characters, there are definitely like a few, you know, rogue accents around in classic film, but they have to be this supporting character that people think are really weird.
The first person I think of when I think of how Hollywood loves to Americanize actors of this period, I think of Cleopatra, I think of Elizabeth Taylor. Taylor is English, but she's playing Egyptian. I think of all those American actors that were slathered in brown face and ended up in these Egyptian, Middle Eastern type of epics of the 50s.
There are countless white American actors that were pulled to play these kinds of parts. This isn't too much of a stretch, but when you hear their accents, it very much is.
When you hear Van Johnson pop up,
I was just about to say that too. Van Johnson is the most all-American actor you can think of.
We're going to talk a lot about Van Johnson because
I want to talk a lot about Van Johnson.
You and I think are going to be talking about two very different things about Van Johnson. This was a big budget epic. They pulled out all the stops for this movie. They wanted to turn Plymouth Adventure into a Ben-Hur, even before Ben-Hur came out. They wanted this to be a huge thing. It was very quickly dubbed MGM's Thanksgiving Turkey. After the movie had done its time at the box office, ended up playing at a loss. Dori Sherry, who was the head of MGM, said, quote, "There weren't enough descendants of the original Mayflower passengers to help it cross over to success." That's a bit of an understatement, Dori, because this movie is just so bizarre. For a movie that looks like it was supposed to be this big action-adventure film, the set of England looks like the setting of The Pirate. You know, it's the MGM castle. So it's very generic, very basic. The ship itself is interesting, the actual Mayflower replica that they have. There's no sense of scope to anything. So when this giant storm comes through and Christopher Jones, Spencer Tracy, is trying to pull the rigging and he's being doused with water, you can just almost see the people in the corners throwing the water on him. It's a very tight shot. There's no sense of magnificence to anything.
It's a very confined set. You almost wonder how everybody slept.
Yeah.
On a ship like that, even though at the beginning it was boasted to be this magnificent 90-foot vessel. But somehow Van Johnson finds the space to sleep. He has more space than anybody else.
Van Johnson practically has an apartment down in the bottom of this boat. The movie is really a sanitized form of the Plymouth Adventure. This is what I call sixth grade history. You know how when you were in sixth grade, they told you about the pilgrims coming to America, but they tended to avoid all the unpleasant stuff, the dying and the slavery and the fact that pretty much they were sending over men to America who were criminals, and that they had to force women to go because nobody wanted to go. The stuff that you end up reading as an adult when you realize, oh God, America's founding was actually really turbulent. This is a very basic version that could only have existed in 1952 without the internet, where the U.S. was still considered this dominant force. And it is coming out right in the middle of the 50s, that era of domesticity. So the women are nice and compliant and obedient and sweet. And the men are he-men out manifest destinying everything.
Although it's very interesting, I feel like there has been no film adaptation of this story. You would think that there would be. Right around this time, there are so many plays and all sorts of media about it, but not really a film. The fact that this movie exists is a marvel in and of itself, at least attempts to tell the story when most films don't.
I've seen movies about the colonization of the U.S. in the latter parts of the decade. I think the Pocahontas narrative is the one that most people know more than anything. The Virginia Company coming to America and interacting with the natives, I think, is something like The New World, if anybody's seen that, or Disney's Pocahontas. That's the narrative people still have problems with, but it seems to be more commonly perceived in media than the actual founding of America with the pilgrims. What I think is really weird, though, is what this movie avoids. There is no first Thanksgiving.
Supposed to be the perfect Thanksgiving film, but they really cut it off before anything quote-unquote interesting happens.
You actually never see John Alden, the Van Johnson character, who is supposedly the first man to actually step foot on Plymouth Rock. You don't actually see that. You don't see any of that. They just come back and they're like, we found land! And that's it.
You don't even really see the rock. Where's the rock?
It's all the boat. That's where I feel like for all the money that was spent on this movie, we can't even get a shot of the other side, what everybody's seeing. We don't even get a shot of land at all during this movie, aside from the intro, where everybody's standing at the fort waiting to get on the boat. They talk about savages, but you never actually see any Native Americans, which I did appreciate. I
appreciate that very much.
I was waiting for Spencer Tracy to take a step onto Plymouth Rock and then a Native American pops out and then they have to like kill him. I think of like Union Pacific. If you listen to the episode that I talked about with Union Pacific, where we were talking about how they're just picking off Native Americans from the side of the train. I was happy that that was not a thing, but this is about Plymouth and going to Plymouth Rock. And we don't actually see that. The movie just ends.
The ending was very abrupt.
There's so much that happens, and then it just peters out.
So one of the biggest failings of the movie, although you could also argue that it's about the journey to America and the quote-unquote hardships that occurred. But, I mean, of course there were hardships, and in that sense, I feel like there is some historical accuracy. I actually did find quite a few events that really lined up with what happened.
In looking at accuracy, I would just assume that all of this is a bunch of lies.
There are definitely accuracies and there are also inaccuracies. One of the things that I found really fascinating was that this is essentially the only film from this time period that shows settlers building framed houses instead of log cabins, which is true. They really did build these framed houses, and log cabins weren't vogue for another 100 years when the Swedish began to build them.
I did not know that.
Exactly.
I do love that Van Johnson uses the printing press as a way to fix the beam on the boat.
That was very clever. I just love seeing him on screen. He's really that all-American. Yes, he's supposed to be English at this point, but he's the perfect example of what America would become. But my big issue is that he's hired to help out, but he's really shown doing that in only a few scenes. I would have loved to see him get more involved on land. Like you said, his character was supposed to be the first person to actually set foot on Plymouth. I would have loved to see that.
You are kinder to Van, I'm a carpenter, Johnson, than I am. So, I don't like Van Johnson. I don't like him. Not like I don't like Dick Powell for personal reasons. I just don't think Van Johnson's that great of an actor. I think he's a good dancer, musical star. But when he is in movies and he's not just hanging out with Judy Garland or something, I am so bored by him. I am bored by everything about him. His freckly face, his curly hair, I don't like him. I'm sure somebody's like, first she besmirches Dick Powell, now it's Van Johnson. I'm sorry.
Not a thing for all-American blonde dudes, I see.
Not classic film. I mean, if we're talking modern day, you and I were just talking off air about the Rebecca remake, and I am all for certain blonde all-Americans in that movie, but this doesn't work for me. Van Johnson is introduced as, he reiterates every 5 minutes, I'm a carpenter. I'm a carpenter. I can do carpentry. I'm assuming that's the only character trait he had. Yeah, that's literally how they sold it. You're going to play John Alden. He's a carpenter. Go with that. And he's very pleasant, but he is just so milquetoast. He is so bland. He's so boring. His relationship with Priscilla Mullins, played by Dawn Adams, which my skin crawled when they were like, she's the only woman non-married over the age of 10 on this boat. And I was just like, oh God, she's the Smurfette of this movie. And I read on Wiki that there's supposed to be a love triangle between her and John Alden, and Miles Standish, played by Noel Drayton. Did you see a triangle between the three of them? Because I did not even know that was a thing.
Absolutely not. I mean, there are a few fight sequences between him and a couple of the sailors, but that was news to me. I read the same thing that you did, and I was just shocked. I was so confused by that.
I mean, maybe the love triangle is between Miles Standish and John Alden. I don't know. Maybe that was the relationship. Because we all know that in the 50s, homoeroticism, that's what I noticed. I did not get their relationship at all. I mean, it's hardly developed. The two have no chemistry, but then the script really doesn't seem too interested in them.
It's very much a, oh, we must have some sort.
We gotta give Van a girl.
Exactly. We have to have some sort of love interest for Van Johnson. Here's the only pretty girl on the boat. Let's pair them together. Sign, seal, delivered. And then they close that book. They're not even really shown together at the end of the film.
I was waiting for, like, that typical MGM close-up of the lovers embraced, looking out to the brave new world.
And waving goodbye to the Mayflower.
Right! We don't even get that! I do think that Miles Standish's mustache is pretty awesome, though.
He was a very attractive man. I would have gone for Miles Standish.
For being on a boat where people are dying, Miles Standish's facial hair is on point. The rest of the cast... they're all, I would say, similarly one note.
You can't really expect a whole lot out of pilgrims. They're supposed to be bland in their portrayals. You know, that's the sort of people that they were considered to be. You know, they're just going to this new world, supposedly for adventure and religious freedom. But that's kind of boring. I mean, who is really a big fan of the story in the first place? Is my question.
Yeah. The movie really doesn't want to look at what brought the pilgrims to America. They talk about religious persecution, kind of. They talk about how William Bradford, played by... is it Leo Genn or Jen?
I'm not sure. I was going to ask
you. We're
going
to call him Jen. If somebody feels that it's a G sound and not a J, feel free to... email us and tell us that's obviously not how we pronounce it. But William Bradford, they talk about how he's leading this group of religious rebels to America, but that's really it. It's like one line. And I get, you can't expect a movie of this era to really dive deep into religious persecution. But when they introduce William Brewster, the Barry Jones character, who is supposed to be hanged in England because of his religious views, I was sitting there thinking, okay, well, then we kind of need to talk about religion, because supposedly these two, I didn't know if they were on the same side, if they were on different sides. Whose side were they on?
I mean, obviously, the group cared about him, cared about saving him. They didn't want to see him hanged. So you can only assume that they had similar, if not the same, religious views. But you make a very good point there. They don't even really dive into that, and that's something that they probably should have done.
And of course, you have our leads. Our leads, who are Captain Christopher Jones, played by Spencer Tracy, and Dorothy Bradford, played by Jean Tierney. How these two ever ended up in a movie called Plymouth Adventure, playing these characters, could have only happened in the studio era. Because any smart person would have been like, why are these two people in this movie? Spencer Tracy, I could understand being in this movie. Jean Tierney, I don't understand being in this movie. Spencer Tracy, I was saying, okay, so it's just the sea wolf, but not good. He's just playing Edward G. Robinson's character from The Sea Wolf, only without that inner turmoil and frustration. Spencer Tracy's portrayal is that of a mean drunk, which was kind of just Spencer Tracy. Everything is, he is so thirsty, and he ain't thirsty for water, he's thirsty for Jean Tierney. Everything about Christopher Jones is that he really wants Dorothy Bradford. He wants her bad. So he gets drunk one night, she's out on the deck just minding her own business, and he, I call it assault.
I would agree with that.
He probably called it just wanting to show her a nice time. He tries to kiss her against her will. She has to be saved by her husband and some other men. But instead of letting that go, the movie just runs with it. At another point, she thanks him for saving her husband. He's just like, yeah, whatever. That's fine. And then they interact again, and he's like, you don't understand how hard my life is. Not just sailing this ship, but spending my nights alone and having these thoughts for you. I mean, he just like goes on this soliloquy about how he really, really wants to sleep with her.
I hate to even mention this, but Jean Tierney doesn't really help matters a whole lot, because literally she spends her entire time on deck staring at this man. She spends more time staring at Spencer Tracy than she does talking to her husband. So this affair was inevitable.
There is no relationship with her husband at all. You're assuming that he just maybe ended up in some sort of arranged marriage with this beautiful woman with a full face of L'Oreal makeup on the Mayflower.
There isn't even any explanation as far as how that relationship came to be, much less how it's going to continue with Spencer Tracy being thirsty.
The movie doesn't want her to end up with William Bradford, her husband. But the movie also can't say that it wants her to end up with Christopher Jones, because her relationship with Spencer Tracy, other than the fact that he looks incredibly older than her, they can darken up his hair all they want. Okay, we know he's about, what, 20 years her senior?
About, yeah.
At a certain point, for reasons that make no sense, they kiss. And I guess she's cool with what happened now, but then she realizes that she broke this, you know, holy covenant with her husband, and we're assuming throws herself overboard.
That's the same conclusion that I was led to as well, but the fact that they just wiped their hands of that.
Yeah, her husband shows up and he's just like, well, I'm single now.
There just was no explanation really from the crew at all. Like, oh, we just assumed that she drowned. Sorry, dude.
We give William Button a better send-off.
That
William
is very
Button
true.
Is the little boy played by Tommy Evo. He wants to be the king of America. He keeps talking about, he sounds like a Dickensian street urchin. I thought his voice was dubbed. It doesn't sound like it comes out of the actor's mouth. He's like, I'm going to be a king of America, I am. Then he gets sick, and everybody bands together to keep him alive. Now, William Button was a real person who was the only child that died in the crossing to America. He has this grand operatic moment where he goes out on deck and he looks out, and we're assuming he sees land, but we never see it from his POV, so he could literally be staring at nothing, and then he dies. But Gene Tierney, who is a major A-list star,
and a main character,
kisses Spencer Tracy and just looks out into the ocean, and we're supposed to believe that she threw herself overboard?
Or drowned.
For all I know, she became a pirate.
I was expecting her to show up at the end and be like, Spencer, I hid all this time from my husband. We can go back to England now.
I'm assuming she just joined up with Maureen O'Hara in one of those pirate films, and they are now pirate women sailing the seven.
I hope so.
That would be great, because it would make me happier. I love Jean Tierney. She is one of my favorites. And the 50s weren't kind to her. Life was not kind to her. Watching her in this just makes me really depressed, because she is so good, and she does not deserve to be the poor victim of this movie that nobody seems to want.
A lot of the reason why we're expected to make this pairing work in the film, knowing what we know now, that supposedly Gene Tierney and Spencer Tracy had an affair off screen.
Oh, I did not know that.
Right. I actually went into her autobiography, because considering the fact that she supposedly had an affair with the leading man, I was very interested to find out if that was the case from her perspective. And I began reading her snippet about Plymouth Adventure that she wrote in her autobiography, Self-Portrait. She said, in one respect, acting is like tennis. When you play with someone who is better than you are, your own game is more likely to improve. I would have loved doing a more interesting part with Tracy, the finest film actor of my time. She actually considers their quote-unquote affair to be a lot more innocent. She said, a few times he asked me to lunch or dinner. He was relieved that my mother came along. These dates were perfectly respectable, but Tracy kept watching the door in case Katharine Hepburn walked in, because she accompanied him to London to film this.
See, that's interesting. And I won't get too deep into the sordid politics of actors' sexuality, because people get mad at me on Twitter and they tell me that. But depending on whose side you believe about the Hepburn-Tracy relationship, whether you believe the William Mann version, which is that both Tracy and Hepburn were gay, or you believe that they were just long time in this extramarital affair together, Gene Tierney picked really weird relationships. She did.
It doesn't make sense to me. I agree with you. I want to believe Gene, obviously, you know, coming from her own mouth.
Based on the background that I know about the rumors and all of that, I'm tending to believe her story more than I would believe that they would have had this affair. Spencer Tracy. I mean, it's not Robert Mitchum.
I don't want to think of him doing anything wrong. I don't know. Even like in movies from the 30s, he seems like this sweet old man, like Carl Fredrickson from Up. He just reminds me very much of him.
See, you know, you and I have different views of Tracy because so many people disliked Spencer Tracy because, again, they said for many years he was a very mean drunk. And so I just always thought that Spencer Tracy was a jerk.
I've actually found that's a very good point because I found that he didn't really get along with very many of the supporting cast members. For instance, he wasn't impressed at all by Don Adams Priscilla's acting abilities. He said, "Who did she sleep with to get this role?"
Yeah, that sounds like a Spencer Tracy quote.
Right. And Peter Lawford was originally cast in a supporting role, too. I can only assume that he was cast in Van Johnson's part because Lawford nearly replaced him in A Guy Named Joe, which he also starred in with Spencer Tracy. But Spencer Tracy instantly disliked him and forced him to be taken off the picture.
The fact that you told me Peter Lawford was almost in this movie just makes me madder because that could have instantly made it better for me.
I would agree with you. He was genuinely British. I feel like he could have offered a lot. I love seeing Van Johnson on screen. He's so cute, but Peter Lawford would have really suited this part too.
Peter Lawford would have been English. For once, his accent would have actually been appropriate.
Exactly.
I'm looking at some of the historical information on IMDb, and Dorothy Bradford, quote unquote, fell overboard and drowned. So she didn't intentionally, allegedly, throw herself overboard, but we're not really sure.
Well, not only that, supposedly Christopher Jones, the captain, was a happily married man with 8 children. One of whom was born while Jones was waiting for the Mayflower to go back to England.
I'm hoping that there are Christopher Jones descendants in the 50s who were just like, screw you, Hollywood. How dare you show our dad as this, like, lecherous guy. I'm really bummed that Peter Lawford could have been in this movie. Again, going back to whatever side you believe, I mean, we know Van Johnson was gay. There were rumors that him and Spencer Tracy had a very close relationship, however you want to delineate that. That Spencer Tracy did fight several times to get Van Johnson on his movies, if there was a possibility. So, like, when he did A Guy Named Joe, like, Van Johnson had been in a really bad car accident. They wanted to replace him, the studio, and Spencer Tracy fought for him and said, no, you're going to put him in this movie or I'm going to walk. And so they did have this very lifelong friendship.
They starred in 4 movies together. This is the last of the 4.
Right, but they don't even interact in the movie. They have, like, 1 scene, and that's it. So go figure. Speaking of final films, this is Clarence Brown, who was the director. This was his final film. I feel sad that he went out on this note because Clarence Brown, if you don't know, was a fantastic film director starting out in silent films, but he did Flesh and the Devil, Anna Christie, A Free Soul, Emma, Night Flight, Sadie McKee, a lot of fantastic movies, National Velvet.
Wife versus Secretary.
Right, Life vs. Secretary, which is a great movie. Angels in the Outfield, which I know is a classic. And in 1952, he had 2 movies, this and When in Rome. Feel like Clarence Brown really just was not suited to the 50s. This was his last movie, and I think he ended up dying in 1987. So he still lived a very long life after this. But this was his final film, and it does show how actors, and really how the 50s, was a real turning point for Hollywood with television and the need for gimmickry to get people into these movie theaters. And a lot of directors just weren't able to handle the transition of telling movies during this time period.
The fact that this is Clarence Brown's last picture really attributes to the large budget. And like you mentioned, the need for Hollywood to amp up their game in order to compete with television, all of these factors, it's easy to see why Plymouth Adventure had such a large budget, but they actually ended up losing money despite earning almost $2 million at the box office. This was the first Spencer Tracy movie to lose money since he joined MGM in 1935.
it's really easy to understand why this movie just fails to impress. It's just not that great. There were a lot of epics that had done really well, stuff like King Solomon's Mines and Quo Vadis. You look at something like Ivanhoe, which is also this old-timey story that came out in 1952. Just, you can see the cobwebs on this movie, even from 1952's perspective. This is just a very creaky story that could be exciting with the right director, but with a basic studio atmosphere, it just feels very, very clunky and dated and old.
It feels like a televised version of a sixth grade play.
I could see this being a high school production right here. I mean, it was Spencer Tracy's biggest hit up until Bad Day at Black Rock. You look at something like Bad Day at Black Rock, which came out 3 years later, that's a very different Spencer Tracy. Gone is the womanizing cad, and in its place is this right fighter trying to get into the heart of racism. Bad Day at Black Rock is just a fantastic movie. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. But here, everybody's just doing really basic work. It feels like a perfect encapsulation of the studio, which is take well-known story, throw in every big actor we have, mix, success. And that didn't always work. And I think this is a prime example of that.
There definitely are highlights. There are things for this film to be commended about. I think the Technicolor is astounding. The cinematography is beautiful. There are some very tight shots that make the compartment within the Mayflower feel very cramped. But of course, this film is well known today for its fantastic special effects. I feel like that Oscar was very well deserved. The water did seem a little bit fake, a little bit false and poured in there, but the beam, it felt very genuine in some scenes, despite, you know, a bit of a wooden acting.
Out of all the movies nominated for Best Special Effects that year, Plymouth Adventure's pretty perfect. This was the only nominee, actually, now that I look at it. They actually didn't have anything. It says literally Best Effects, winner Plymouth Adventure. There are no other nominations. So I'm assuming special effects was just kind of something, if they had something, they nominated it and it won.
It does deserve it, though. I think it would have won in any case.
I do want to talk about, before we close it out, my favorite character of the movie, which was Lloyd Bridges as Coppin.
Really?
Christopher Jones is perpetually shirtless Guy Friday. I don't know why he doesn't own a shirt in this entire movie. Yes, I know it's because he's a sailor and there's hard work happening with sailoring, but it is just really comical watching his character show up in the first scene and he's all bronzed and burly and sweaty, and that's pretty much his entire wardrobe for the entire movie. Yes, sometimes he wears a shirt or a sweater, but it's very rare, and it's the weirdest thing. But I found it to be really hilarious. It's like watching a Cliff Robertson movie. If anybody's seen like Cliff Robertson movies from the 50s where he just never had a shirt. And you're like, why is he at a beach party and he's got a sweater tied around his neck? I don't know why, but it's awesome at the same time. It's my little shout out to Lloyd Bridges, who I think really elevates this movie.
He is the perfect example of the Peter Pan-esque, burly, brawny, beastly pirate. He's the live-action version.
Why he did not do a Peter Pan movie in the 50s is beyond me, because he's pretty perfect for it.
He really does add something to the film, some sort of personified antagonist, where all of the other antagonists are the weather and the sicknesses. That's a person that you can actually focus your attention on.
And keep in mind, this movie was 6 years before he did Sea Hunt. He was on the sea well before that. Samantha, anything else we want to discuss before we wrap up our thoughts on Plymouth Adventure?
I would still recommend the film. It's a great one. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it for Thanksgiving Day, now that I've seen it. I'm really glad that I did watch it, but I think that TCM made a very sound choice in showing it a few days beforehand, because it's sort of a journey into Thanksgiving rather than a Thanksgiving film.
I'm giving it a very tentative recommend, purely out of curiosity.
Exactly.
Purely out of curiosity. This is not a good movie, but if you really just want to see the weirdest movie that Gene Tierney ever did, I'm sure somebody's going to email me and be like, actually, this is the weirdest movie she ever did. It's going to be like the sci-fi film. I don't know. I think it's the weirdest Gene Tierney movie I've ever seen. It's bizarre. For a big, opulent spectacle film, it feels very, very small and televised. And it's just boring. When you really get down to it, it's just boring. And I wanted it to at least maybe be campy enough to make fun of, or serious enough that there might be some drama there, but it's just so basic.
It really is that in between. I expected when I chose it that it would be something that we could laugh at and point out every blaring historical inaccuracy, but there weren't that many.
No, mostly because they never leave the boat.
They pretty much stuck to the bare minimum on the boat, the basic facts, and it's pretty open and shut.
Maybe if they had Peter Lawford.
Maybe. I think that could have saved it. If the costumes were a little more ridiculous, if there were a few more fight scenes, I think it would be a hilarious.
If the camera film. Maybe showed something on the other side of the boat. Maybe if they'd actually shown The Rock. Maybe if they'd shown Plymouth Rock.
I would have loved for this movie to end with everyone, instead of signing that paper, if they had signed The Rock. carved into The Rock, and then they carved the end into The Rock.
I would just love it if they just ended on a glowing picture of a rock, and you're like, what is that? Oh, it's supposed to be Plymouth Rock? Well, that's unimpressive. I'd have at least liked that, but go figure. Hopefully, if you watch Plymouth Adventure this year with your family, you are not going to be bored, but it's very, very interesting. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review for us. As always, you can contact us directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. And if you're on Twitter, you can also follow the podcast at ticklish_biz. If you want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast it is. If you become a patron right now, you can listen to a few episodes of my two new supplementary shows. Based on a True Podcast is the show I do with co-host William Bibbiani, where we look at how Hollywood talks about itself in cinema and television. Our latest episode looks at the horror film Shadow of a Vampire. We're actually getting ready to discuss our next episode, which is going to be about Jennifer Love Hewitt as Audrey Hepburn in The Audrey Hepburn Story. Smith, have you seen that movie?
I haven't. I've heard about it, but it sounds really interesting.
It is on YouTube, and it is actually not the worst made-for-TV biopic that I've seen. There are worse. It's something. You can also hear Adam Kautzer and I talk about all three versions of The Bad Seed on Double Features, a supplemental show where we look at the features Hollywood films again and again. And you can also check out my interviews with author Alan K. Rohde, TCM tour guide Sarah Louise Lilly. If you're interested in becoming a patron, head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year, as we've been documenting in my centennial celebration, you can head over to TCM's exclusive fan club, TCM Backlot, and read my year-long series, Centennial Celebration, about the stars we've spotlighted. I talk about films and share information that we don't talk about on the podcast. But next time, Samantha and I and Drea will also be back. We're going to be talking about a Christmas movie. Now, patrons, if you are a Patreon subscriber, you can actually help us decide what our holiday film is going to be.
I'm really excited for that. We have some good choices.
We do. So if you head over to patreon.com right now and you donate $2 or more, you can vote in our exclusive Christmas poll. We've already done Meet Me in St. Louis, The Bishop's Wife, Christmas in Connecticut, Miracle on 34th Street. All of those have already been recorded. You can find them on the Ticklish Biz feed. But right now we are deciding between the Barbara Stanwyck, Fred McMurray feature, Remember the Night, Janet Leigh and Robert Mitchum in Holiday Affair, and the perennial Christmas favorite, White Christmas. So right now, it is a dead heat between Holiday Affair and White Christmas. So help us break that streak by considering helping us out and supporting the show and getting to vote in this awesome poll. But Drea, Samantha, and I will be back next time to talk about whatever wins that poll and celebrate the Christmas season. Samantha, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
I have a Twitter now. It's at Classic Film Geek, and you can follow me and keep up with me on my blog, musingsofaclassicfilmaddict.wordpress.com.
Awesome. Well, that's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. Till next time.